Friends, as the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is instinct, intellect, intuition. We say that man is separated from animal by a tremendous gulf at the level of mind. Of course, there is intelligence in animal kingdom. What man shares with animals is instinct, but not reasoning, thinking, and intuitive power. In fact, instinct, intellect, intuition may be looked upon as but three stages in the evolutionary progress and process. In fact, theosophy speaks of doctrine of emanation rather than evolution. So we say that first there is involution and then there is evolution. There is descent of spirit into matter and then evolution or ascent of the spirit through matter. And so impulse to evolution comes from spirit, which technically we call as Atma Buddhi Monad. It is this monad which evolves better and better forms through which it expresses itself. So, we might say, the whole process may be described as unfoldment from within without. The second aspect of the doctrine of emanation is that this progress, growth does not happen automatically, but it is aided by intelligent beings, intelligent powers, which assist nature. Now, as we said, first there is involution of the spirit in matter. And that spirit we often describe as an aspect of Parabrahma, one reality, one consciousness, one life. And therefore, all through the process of evolution, where this spirit, this monad, gains experience by passing through a variety of forms, we see but the expression of this consciousness in variety of ways. In minerals, we see sympathy and antipathy, attraction and repulsion, cohesion and dispersion. This can be looked upon as psychic intelligence or even instinct. And in fact, as Mr. Grosky writes, that we would not be able to use certain chemicals, or rather chemicals in the chemical laboratory, if there was not the psychic intelligence inherent in these chemicals. How is it that we combine sulfuric acid with copper and we are sure of getting copper sulfate with hydrogen gas liberated? That is because of this inherent psychic intelligence in the minerals, in the chemicals. Similarly, this consciousness we find also in plant, expressing itself in terms of sensation. Touch me not plant will immediately fold the leaves at the slightest touch, and sunflower turns in the direction of the sun. And likewise, a parasite would grow on a particular tree. For instance, we know mistletoe will always grow on oak tree, where it derives its nutrition from oak, but in turn there is also oak which is dependent on mistletoe for its life. Cut down the mistletoe and oak would wither. Likewise, we have carnivorous plants, and here also we see this intelligence, this instinct, where for instance in the pitcher plant, which is actually shaped like a pitcher, like a jug of water, where the mechanism is such that it will trap small insects and then kill them and sustain itself on these killed insects, and so on. So here again we see consciousness functioning in a definite way, a sort of instinctual happenings in variety of plants. In fact, we know that Gerald Darren, in one of his books, has made a mention of flowers having a personality of their own. And he says that if you keep daisies with roses, then soon roses would wither. There is a sort of antipathy between the roses and the daisies. And similarly, we know how HPB says that there is a sympathy between wine and olive tree, but there is antipathy between wine and a cabbage. And so this sympathy and antipathy, which we are familiar so as being instinct, psychic intelligence, is therefore to be seen even in the plant kingdom. Then we come to animal kingdom, and we do find instinct in a most marked and definite way functioning. So there is instinct for self-preservation, there is instinct for migration, instinct for protecting the young ones, instinct for procreation and propagation of species. And in this instinct, we see that there is wisdom. It's not blind. It's not chance. In fact, it never works haphazardly. And this wisdom is there in what they eat and what they avoid. For instance, we all know that dogs, pet dogs especially, we observe that they would stop eating when they don't feel the stomach being all right. And that's the best way to recover. And certain kinds of dogs and cats would go and eat certain kinds of grasses. Then the result is that they would vomit. And as a result of vomit, they would throw out the unwanted things out of the system. And this is again the best way to get back the health. So here in the first quotation, Mr. Crosby says, instinct is a direct perception of what is right within its own realm. Animals have right instinct in regard to what to eat and in regard to what is dangerous to them, for their instinct is acquired experience. But they do not reason in their instincts. They feel them. And we see therefore that one of the things which is mentioned is that it is acquired experience, and secondly, there is wisdom in this instinct. Now sometimes we do find that in the instinct we see a certain amount of clairvoyance at work. For instance, we are told that during World War I, they used to make use of parrots which were placed on the military fortresses. And even before their detection systems could detect the approaching aeroplane, the parrots used to detect them and they would begin screeching. Similarly, we do see this in the dogs. We say that many times in the night, for several nights, the dogs cry. That is to say, there is wailing and a peculiar howling which goes on for 2, 3 or more nights. Sure enough, either the owner or someone in the vicinity then passes away. The approaching death is sensed, which we may call as sixth sense, which we may call as instinct. And likewise, now it's become amply clear that whenever there is an earthquake or a tsunami which is to come, animals would feel them, sense the approaching thing even before we do, and therefore they would migrate. Every time there is an earthquake or tsunami, they notice very, very, very definitely that lots of dead bodies of human beings may be found, but not a single carcass or dead body of the animal is to be found. Unless, of course, the animal was held captive and therefore he couldn't run away. But otherwise, they sense it before us. Now, this is instinct. Also, we said that it is acquired experience. So, in Encyclopedia Britannica, we've been given the instance of a young jackdaw. Jackdaw is a bird of the family of crow. And a young jackdaw, they say, would, at the time of nest building, would try and gather all kinds of materials. Anything that it can really pick up in its beak. So, they would pick up small pebbles, threads, they would pick up wires, metal wires, electrical wires, even broken bulbs. Many things it will pick up. Try and wedge it in the branches to make a nest. But when they find that it's unsuitable, then it will finally pick up the twigs. There again, there are thicker and thinner twigs, flexibility and size. Finally, it will settle down to bringing the right material for building nest. On the other hand, a songbird is found to be getting just the right stuff. To build a nest in every phase of his nest construction. This is because in case of the songbird, we find that over many generations, this experience, which was garnered first by trial and error, just like a young jackdaw is doing, and then they settled upon certain material, certain method of building the nest, that was passed on from one generation to another. And then, of course, now we see the songbird very easily picking up the right thing in order to build a nest. Now, talking about these acquired experience and instinct, naturally, we may want to know what is instinct. One of the things suggested by the Darwinian theory is the law of natural selection. They say that, first of all, to begin with, there were pre-existing types. And then, as a result of change in the climate and many factors, there was a need to bring about change in the organism. And therefore, through experience, it was felt that we need to adapt our bodies to the changing conditions and circumstances and environment. And therefore, these changes were brought about in the body of the organism, and these same changes were passed on to next generation through genetic constitution, through genes, genotype, and so on. Now, here we find that therefore natural selection is the law which says that the fit survive and the unfit are eliminated. Ishvari says yes, very true. Useful variations are something which are integrated in the body of the animal. But she says, but who or what is it that decides that these are the useful variations? What are the causes which, as it were, determine what are the useful variations? Of course, Darwin, that is at the scientific level, they give causes like change in climate, dietary change, isolation. So, if there was, for instance, the climate which was sort of warm, then it starts becoming little cold and then freezing cold. Accordingly, there will be changes in the very hide, in the very skin of the animal, till finally it will develop the furs on the body. Of course, similarly, if the food that the animal was taking goes on becoming solid, it will have to develop sharp teeth. Alright, these, she says, are secondary causes. But what is that which actually gauges that this is the change which is needed and then actually brings about the change? Sees to it that the change is brought about in the organism. Do we not think that there must be some intelligence at work? So, she points out in a certain way that this instinct may, for the sake of exact definition, be termed automatic. But it must have either within the animal which possesses it or without something or someone's intelligence to guide it. And we call this the Vyajohanic impulse, Fohatic impulse. In short, as we said, assistance of beings who are on the higher scale of evolution. Now, of course, coming back to also the idea of instinct where it is acquired experience, we see something else. That when this acquired experience is passed on to another generation and so on, in case of animals, we find that it can only follow the instinct and can do no better. In case of danger, there is a fight or flight instinct. Sepia, the kind of animal which you find in the oceans and in the water, it will let out a sort of chemical to create a cloud, a cloudy kind of a thing. And then it will confuse the enemy and then run away. But besides these mechanisms which are there, which it will instinctually use, more than that, it cannot do anything else. And so, we are told by HPP that many years back, lemmings used to cross or rather swim in the Atlantic Ocean in order to arrive at an island, which used to be almost in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, the Atlantic continent or the Atlantic island. Now, it went on for a long time, but then this island was submerged. And still, it was found that these lemmings would continue to swim, not finding the land. They would continue to swim some more, and finally, being exhausted, they would all be drowned. And so, they would perish by the thousands. And this went on for some time, till finally, they would really realize that the change must be brought about. And therefore, in the next quotation, we are told that what we call instincts are but the blind and sometimes even prejudicial inheritance of previously acquired experiences. So, this acquired experiences may help you to a certain extent, but when there is a change, for some time, the animal doesn't know what to do. And then that intelligence within begins to work and brings about the necessary change or the necessary new instinct, as it were, is developed. Now, we can see that as opposed to this, in man, you find instinct working in a different way, in the sense that as compared to animals, man's instinct is not so well developed. In fact, it works in terms of reflexes. Someone brings a finger too close to the eye and automatically the eye will close. Or the involuntary functions, breathing, contraction and expansion of heart muscles, dilation of the pupil, etc. All these are instinctual functions. And here we see that it is because some sort of impressions have been made on the atoms and cells of the body. Come to think of it, instinct is something where there is a recalling of memory of past experience. And therefore, in instinct there are ready-made nerve connections. A certain stimulus and there is a definite or a fixed reaction given to that stimulus. That is how instinct functions. So in one sense, we can say that our legs, the atoms which form our legs, they have been impressed with certain kind of memory, and therefore, when that memory comes back, in a very little time, we see the child beginning to walk. The cells and atoms of the vocal cord also bring back the memory. And therefore, in a very little while, we find that these cells and atoms adjust themselves and the child begins to talk. The voice is thrown out and so on. We find that in certain cases, therefore, when a person had died by being drowned in water, there is instinctual fear of water. When he was burnt in fire, all the sheaths of the soul, that is the physical body, the astral body and other sheaths, they have been so impressed with this fear for fire. That whole experience is so much deeply and strongly impressed that he would have instinctual fear of fire. Now, apart from that, we do see that whereas the baby animal would instinctively remain away from fire or water, the baby of human being has no such instinct. So very merrily it will go and put the hand into gas or a stove that is burning, or maybe even jump into a lake or pond and so on. So this is the difference between the animal and the human instinct. And in fact, we are told that human beings, on the other hand, have reasoning, which has been acquired at the expense of instinct. We have lost a certain amount of instincts and we have gained, in fact, the reasoning power. Of course, we are not saying that the animals don't have intellect or intelligence, that they are mindless. And many times what is done by animals is so intelligent that people start thinking that there is one little step now for them to become human beings or become humans, or they are almost like human beings. But there is a dead curve. Things that we are referring to are something like that which was observed by the researchers at the Buffalo University in dolphins and monkeys. They said that yes, there are animals, there are organisms which can discriminate, they can differentiate. But when they are able to do something more, when they are able to say that I don't know, that is knowledge about knowing, which they call as metacognition, that is something far superior to any kind of intelligence and discrimination. And this is what they felt was exhibited by dolphin. They had a dolphin and they were experimenting with this dolphin. So they would play certain sounds, high pitch, low pitch, and when they play high pitch sound, then this dolphin would press a red button, a low pitch sound, and the dolphin would press green button. Then they started playing sound which was confusing, not too high, not too low, and closely similar sounds. And then dolphin stopped pressing the button. They inserted a third button, and every time they played this kind of ambiguous sounds, neither high nor low, it would go and press a third button as if to say, I'm not sure, I don't know. So this metacognition, they felt, showed a very high kind of intelligence. It's knowledge of knowing or not knowing the thing. Then HPB of course says about discrimination that in her own time, a Russian scientist, Sinkovsky, had observed this, not in dolphin and monkeys, but in a unicellular organism called amoeba. And she says that this amoeba would be put in a kind of a tank of water in which many small plants would be there, many other kinds of worms and food would be there. But very carefully it will find its path and way to where there was placed a spirogyra. That is the only thing on which it will feed, carefully avoiding all the other kinds of plants and food. Now this discrimination to eat only a certain thing in a unicellular organism like amoeba was amazing. He said, I feel as if I'm watching a self-conscious being making some sort of a choice. Now also, we find that the cells which are there in the lining of the intestine, they selectively choose and absorb certain nutrients, reject others as a waste and so on. Now also, it has been observed in case of monkeys, it has been observed in case of gorillas, how very few years back there was a female gorilla who was seen to be taking a stick. In order to cross a pool of water, she would take the stick not for support but to plumb the depth of water. How deep is the water that she was trying to reach? And making use of other tools, like taking a long blade of grass and then pushing it inside a hole so that it will, termites would adhere to it, take it out and then eat them. Or even trying to break a coconut with a stone. All these things they felt was an extremely intelligent thing to do for animals. And then again, they take mirrors in which reflections are shown. It is found in case of peahens and one or two other birds that when they looked at their reflection, the reaction which was given, the behavior which was exhibited, it looked as if they were aware that they were looking at their own image, that this is me kind of a thing. So they felt that even they are very close to having self-consciousness. Well, in a way they are right, because we are told in theosophy that in animal kingdom, the monad, the atmabuddhi, is very close to being individualized. And it is individualized in man as a result of the lighting up of manas. And so we see that in man, we see a far different and a superior kind of intelligence as well as intuition. Whereas in animals, we don't see this. In fact, this from earlier issue of the Theosophical Movement makes very clear that our use of thinking faculty is a self-conscious use. The animal's use of the thinking faculty is non-self-conscious. That is, the real meaning of the word, and that is the real meaning of the word psychic, which is the non-self-conscious use of the mind and soul. You think that it is thinking, but it's not really thinking the way we do. And in the second quotation, it is made clear, the animal's mind enables it to put one and one together, so to say, and make two. But it does not permit putting one and two and three together to make it six. In other words, no animal is capable of sequential reasoning. And that is what we mean by reasoning mind. Because there is nothing to weld the links of thought together. What does it take? A thinker, that is a self-conscious form of life. So, the sequential logical reasoning is something which requires a thinker. We say man, Manushya, is a thinker. And how and when did he become a thinker? So, to that HPB, as we said, that Theosophy says that at one point in time, man was no better than an animal himself. But when his brain became of much better and much deeper capacity than that of any other animal, he was given the light of mind, variously referred to in other philosophies as Agnishvata Pitris, Kumaras, Manasaputras, or by the god Prometheus, who is supposed to have stolen fire from heaven and brought to earth. But this lighting up of the mind was activating the mind, which was dormant, and that is what it is in the lower kingdoms. Mind is still dormant, and when it was activated, it endowed man with the power to think, power to choose, making him self-conscious, and also allowing him a perception. Man is the only being who can stand aside and evaluate his thoughts. He can become a witness of his thoughts. He can become a witness to his emotions. He can stand aside and watch the pain, analyze his pain. The one aspect will experience and be immersed in the pain, but another aspect can really remain away and do analysis of this pain and so on. Now all this is not there in the animal at all. This is because the mind is lighted up. And with the lighting up of manas, we are told that certain ideas of art, science, agriculture, architecture, sculpture, spiritual knowledge, they were burnt into imperishable center of man's consciousness. These we know today as innate ideas, inherent ideas. So there is, in a way, we can say, there is innate sense of morality, unless we have almost killed it by several lifetimes of wrong behavior. But otherwise, there is that innate sense of morality, innate sense of justice, innate sense of right and wrong. This is what is the result of these ideas which are there. Now, if you look at, in fact, the mind of man, we say that it can function at three levels. There is mind, which we call generally as the lower mind, which the Buddhist teacher Sangharakshita calls everyday mind, which requires stimulus. It is the mind which reacts to the stimuli from without. You see something, you like it, you go and buy it. Someone says something angry and we react. So constantly that mind is driven by likes and dislikes, or prejudices and biases, attachments. So that thinking is very much colored by our prejudices, biases, thinking, emotions and so on. This is kama manas. Then there is the mind which acts on its own play, manas per se, which is the reasoning, logical mind, reasoning from premises to conclusion. But when, very, very rarely this mind frees itself from both kama as well as being a reasoning mind, it can temporarily unite itself to the divine, to Atma Buddhi, becoming Buddhi Manas. And that is when we have intuitive mind, intuitive perception. Now coming back to kama manas, we are told that this is what we share with animals. However, as we said, even the kind of thinking that we do, although influenced by our kama and desire, we don't see it happening in animal. And that is because we are told that our brain is superior to that of the animal. So it should be said that the psychic element or kama manas is common to both the animal and the human being. The far higher degree of its development in the latter, that is, in man, is resting merely on the great perfection and sensitiveness of his cerebral cells. The cells of the brain in man, they are far more sensitive and far more developed as compared to the brain in the animal. Now coming back to the idea that there are these innate or inherent ideas in man, spiritual ideas, as well as ideas of art, science, agriculture, architecture, etc. HPP therefore says that man has not come to be what he is, a highly civilized being, especially in the ancient times when we see Roman and Egyptian civilization with their architecture and their sculpture, etc. It is very difficult to understand that the caveman and a Stone Age man suddenly came to be simply by evolution to this stage. So she says, let those who doubt this statement, that is, mind of man was lighted up by great beings, and it is these great beings who impressed in his mind or in his consciousness these great ideas. If you doubt that statement, let them explain the mystery of the extraordinary knowledge possessed by the ancients, alleged to have developed from lower and animal-like savages, the cavemen of the Paleolithic age, or any other equally reasonable grounds. Let them turn to such works as those of Vitruvius Pollio of the Augustan age. On architecture, for instance, in which all the rules of proportion are those taught anciently at initiations, if he would acquaint himself with a truly divine art and understand the deep exoteric significance hidden in every rule and law of proportion. No man descended from a Paleolithic cave dweller could ever evolve such a science unaided even in millenniums of thought and intellectual evolution. So, as we said, this divine intervention of highly evolved beings is very necessary if we want to understand the intellect of man. It is not an automatic kind of evolution. Now, however, we are also told that this intelligence must always be guided by heart quality. One, intelligence, that is reasoning from premises to conclusion, is a very slow process. And as Light on the Path says, that is not the only way of acquiring knowledge. Knowledge is not just acquired by experimenting in the laboratory, by reasoning from premises to conclusion. There is a better way of, or a much superior way of acquiring the knowledge. And the simile, the example, the metaphor given is that our knowledge which we call as reasoning knowledge it's something like entering a room which is dark, and you feel your way in the room by touching various things, and that is how you become aware as to what things are there, etc. But intuitive knowledge is like switching on the light, and at one go you become aware of things which are in the room. So this is the difference. And moreover, intellect alone can very easily bring about a downfall of a person. We see that you can use intelligence to help a drowning man by extending a pole to him. But you can also keep the drowning man beneath the water by pushing him down with a pole. The same intelligence can be used in a good or in a bad way, depending upon whether we are guided by our heart quality or not. And in fact, we do see in the terrorist activities, it's no longer always a case of a person misguided by some religious authority, etc. But more than that, there is a mastermind. Whenever there is a terrorist attack, they speak about a mastermind who has well thought the plan in such a way that not a single person may escape the attack, and so on and so forth. And so here we are told, if the thinker then becomes wholly intellectual, the entire nature begins to tend downward. For intellect alone is cold, heartless, selfish, because it is not lighted up by two other principles, buddhi and atma. And as we said earlier, the process of acquiring knowledge only through experiment and reasoning is a slow process. So here, in the Secret Doctrine, HVP says, only those who realize how far intuition soars above the tardy processes of ratiocinative thought can form the faintest conception of that absolute wisdom which transcends the ideas of time and space. Now this intuition is when the mind can free itself from karma, and temporarily also it joins itself so as to receive the guidance from the divine nature. And the simplest example of it, which we generally describe as a hunch, gut feeling, it comes into play when we are solving the crossword puzzle and there is an anagram to be solved. It's a jumbled word. Suppose you have P-A-P-E-L and you are trying to see what is the word which is hidden in this jumble. And then we have to write down all possible combinations of the word P-A-P-E-L. And then we may know that yes, it is the word apple. But most of the time we know we don't have to do this, because you look at the word, stare at it for a while, and you know this is the word that is there in the anagram. So this is a very, very small example. And likewise, we do see that more or less in life, in our own field, we are coming to be a little intuitive. It is experience which has cleared the mind to a certain extent, the knowledge which also tends to purify the mind to a certain extent when we are using it for its own sake. And more than that, the concern, the feeling that we want to do something good for others using that knowledge, all that combined brings into play the intuition. So this is a very simple way of putting, but Dr. Eric Byrne, the psychologist, says, intuition means that we can know something without knowing how we know. Just as old family doctor would diagnose typhoid fever by the smell because of his vast experience with the disease, so also observant psychiatrist learns to judge many things about his patients by intuition. He makes a shrewd guess by observing the patient. Any professional can become intuitive about his own business. So, and this several examples, you can actually multiply examples. For instance, a doctor in Africa, she had a lady patient coming to her for some gynec problem. But as she was checking her, why but her, something within kept on saying that check her heart. And sure enough, she finally checked the heart, doing all that ECG, etc. And immediately she was sure that this lady was suffering from that heart disease which was very common with women in that area. And so of course she was taken on the operation table and operated upon, and she was saved. But this thing, there was no reason. The lady looked all right, she had not complained, but the doctor kept feeling that she must check the heart of this woman. So in your own profession, if we sincerely want to help, then somewhere that intuition, the voice from within, as it were, guides us in the right direction. And of course, we have been told as to how to develop this intuition. And it is said that by giving it exercise. In everyday life, every time there is a moral dilemma, if we put that proposition before our heart and ask, guide me, what should I do in this matter? Instead of running around and asking five other people, let us ask this higher nature. And then we will find that many times, rather than being the voice of the spirit, it is the voice of our animal nature which will guide. If we desire to go with a friend for a movie rather than coming for a meeting, then of course we will hear the voice saying that yes, you should go for a movie because after all you are seeing this friend after so many years. But the meeting doesn't matter. Then in the hindsight probably we will reason out and we will find that no, that was not the voice of my higher nature, it was the voice of my animal nature. So we learn from mistake, but that doesn't matter. As we are sincere, it is said that gradually this intuition will become clearer. There will be intuition with certainty at one point in time. So Mr. Judge says, first of all, by giving it exercise, you can develop intuition. And second, by not using it for purely personal ends. Exercise means that it must be followed through mistakes and bruises until from sincere attempts at use, it comes to its own strength. At first, we will make errors. But soon, if we are sincere, it will grow brighter and make no mistake. The most important thing that is suggested for developing intuition is development of the heart quality. What are the things that will happen to the mind if it has to be receptive? Two, that wisdom, ideas, guidance, which is already there in our divine nature, is to make it pure. And as we've seen earlier, that to make this mind receptive and pure, we must get the depth of mind, the breadth of mind, by constantly remaining in touch with the scriptures, with universal ideas like karma and rebirth. This is the process which must go on all our life, from life to life. So dealing with the metaphysical things, etc., will give a sort of a purity to the mind, depth to the mind. But the most important thing is to have the heart quality of mind. And that is why we are told by Mr. Dutch that every impulse from above, every prompting of the divine within should meet at once with a hearty welcome and response. If you feel as if something urged you to visit some sick or afflicted neighbor or friend, obey the suggestion without delay. If the wish to turn over a new leaf comes into the lower consciousness, don't wait till next New Year's before actually turning it over. Turn it now. If some pathetic story of suffering has moved you, act on the emotion while your cheeks are still wet with tears. In short, put yourself at once in line with the divine ways, in harmony with the divine laws. More light, more wisdom, more spirituality must necessarily come to one, thus prepared, thus expected.